The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO abduction phenomenon. Actually, we have three guests sharing the stage with us today. Scott Ramsey is the foremost researcher in the Aztec incident, having worked on the story since 1987, discovering archives and pursuing interviews throughout the U.S. His entire career has been in the electrical industry, specializing in magnetic fields and electrical wire. He has worked for the for Fortune 500 companies and currently is vice president of sales and marketing for Express Wire Services in Charlotte, North Carolina. He is married to Suzanne Ramsey, whom he met in Four Corners area of New Mexico while doing research. Suzanne Ramsey discovered the Aztec incident after her mother read Frank Scully's 1950 book, Behind the Flying Saucers. Having grown up in the Midwest, her family moved to live in the Four Corners area, where Suzanne owned a small business and pursued media writing and hosting a radio show. She met and married Scott after he appeared on her show to discuss his research. Suzanne has traveled extensively, interviewing and pursuing research at universities and the United States Air Force Archives. She is the CEO of Carolina Country Provisions, whose main product is Uncle Scott's All Natural Root Beer. The Ramseys live in Mooresville, North Carolina, where their Aztec research continues. Also, Frank Thayer, PhD. So Dr. Frank Thayer came to the Aztec Incident Project in 2009, when Scott Ramsey shared witness information of the recover at Hart Canyon. Thayer is a New Mexico native with extensive journalistic and journalism education experience. Now a professor emeritus at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. He has a professional experience as a writer, editor, photographer, and educator both in New Mexico and Canada, where he has taught for 11 years. He is a published author and is co-author of the Ramsey's successful 2012 book, The Aztec Incident: Recovery at Hart Canyon. Both Scott and Suzanne have been on this show in the past, but their continued research has afforded much more data to share. Plus, we're happy to have their co-author, Dr. Frank Thayer, with us as well. So there's a lot to cover. So let's get started with Scott Ramsey. Hello, Scott.
Hello, David.
How are you?
I'm doing fine.
So let's get right into it. Tell us where this crash occurred.
Aztec, New Mexico is about 12 and a half miles, or the actual crash site is about 12 and a half miles northeast of the town of Aztec. Mm-hmm. Aztec, New Mexico is up in the Four Corners area, in the Farmington, Bloomfield area. And it's probably a 3.5 hour drive from Albuquerque.
Okay. And describe this UAP sighting and crash.
Well, crash happened March 25th, 1948 is when it was discovered. It was discovered by oil field workers that were actually responding to a brush fire. And as they came up upon the brush fire, there was a concern because there were some oil drip tanks nearby. It's all oil field out there. And once they got up on top of the crash site, they noticed this big, large lenticular disc that was laying on top, not near the fire, but up on top of the mesa. Mm-hmm. So that's how the story got started. And later that day, it grew into oil field workers. A Baptist minister came by, a Baptist priest, and some local people. So it was a well-documented event as far as the amount of people that were there.
So what did this craft look like, according to them?
Just shy of 100 feet in diameter. It was probably about 18 feet in height. It appeared to have three levels to it. The upper deck level were portholes that they could look in and see at least two beings that looked like they were dead or knocked out. They were slumped over their controls. Mm. And later it was revealed there was anywhere from 14 to 16 occupants on board.
Wow. Well, were they able to get into the craft?
They actually were. The portholes were a kind of aluminized, like our sunglasses, in color. They're very difficult to see. One of the oil field workers noticed that there was a hole in one of the portholes about the size of a quarter. And they got poking around in there with some instruments off the oil rigs, oil field trucks, and somehow activated a lever that released a staircase that came down.
Staircase.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble talking today. My allergies are in full bloom right now.
Tell me about it. I know that. At any rate, this was a 100-foot craft, you say. And describe these beings that they witnessed.
They said they were about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. They were childlike in appearance. They weren't the typical, you hear people report, large head, big almond eyes. They were more childlike in appearance. Mm. All wearing the same type of jumpsuit. It was a blue material. No insignia, nothing on it.
Did they say these jumpsuits had zippers or Velcro? Or
they had buttons.
They had buttons.
Would appear to be buttons, yeah.
Hmm. Now, to my knowledge, buttons were available here on Earth.
That's right.
Before 48, yes?
Yeah.
In fact, World War I, the soldiers' uniforms were all buttons, pants, right. Buttons. So at any rate, and I think World War II as well. Anyway, so... These were buttons, so they knew all about that. So a 100-foot craft, how would you get a 100-foot craft off a mesa in the desert of New Mexico?
That's a good question. We asked ourselves that question back in the beginning of early 2000, mm-hmm. And we decided to reenact moving the craft. According to Frank Scully's book, The Craft Came Apart, and his original book, Behind the Flying Saucers. And so using what he put in his book, which appears to be very accurate, we hired Bill Metzger, who is probably the world's foremost expert in moving large equipment. That's what he did all his life, either by train, by barge, by whatever.
What year, I'm sorry, what year was this that you...
2009, I think it was, wasn't it?
2009?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Please go ahead.
So we flew Pam and Bill Metzger out to Aztec. Suzanne and I met him out there. We spent a week, and we went from the crash site all the way down to Highway 64 leading toward Los Alamos, because that would be the most difficult. That was where all the what we call pinch points were. Once we got down to Largo Canyon, then it was wide open pretty much the whole way. And we reenacted it twice to make sure. And we had rods and sticks to simulate how large the pieces would be on a flatbed. And the military back then had an amazing amount of Dragon wagons. That was the M-24 and M-25. They were the tank transport planes tanks that were used in World War II. And they were all-wheel drive, chain driven. And ironically, we found out they were actually, after World War II, down at what is now Holloman Air Force Base, just in storage. So that would have been easy access to get them. And there were times it was going to be really tight. We cleared some of those spaces of the canyons by inches in some cases. But the fact was, we were able to truck it out of there, as they claimed in Frank Scully's book.
I'll be darned. So Frank Scully's book was ridiculed at first, wasn't it?
Well, I don't think the book was ridiculed. The two people that were spoon-feeding him information were ridiculed. And that was Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer. And I think if you look at our research and research other people have done on the two quote-unquote con men, you'll find that there wasn't really much of a con to what they did.
They call them con men, huh?
They've been referred to as con men. The whole thing, they claim that they fed the story to Scully. And, you know, when you're conning somebody, at the end of the day, you're getting something from them, money or whatever. And these guys told Frank Scully the story with nothing in hanging in return. So I don't know how they could really claim they were con men.
Right. Right. I tell my story of my my sighting and close encounter sighting. And I've had people say, you know, that this is not true, it wouldn't be, yada yada. This is before the Pentagon admitted they're real.
Right.
And I don't get that so much anymore. At any rate, I would say, you know, what do I have to gain by this? Right. Oh, well, you've written books. Yeah, well, you don't get rich off of, I don't have to tell you, you know, you're rich off of writing books on UFOs.
Yeah.
You know? And so at any rate, I don't capitalize on telling my story and interviewing people. You see, I'm not the expert. You guys are the experts because you have done the research. All I do is provide a platform for people like you to come on and tell their story. So I've done enough talking. We've got to get back to you. Was there any physical evidence of this incident?
There is, on the Mesa today, there's a lot of physical evidence that something crashed up there. Even people that don't buy into the UFO flying saucer story will say, yes, something crashed up here. You can tell the way the terrain has been moved. The trees have been mowed down. Even after all these years, some of the dead trees, we were careful to move and toward the northwestern end of the crash site so they would be preserved and not used for campfire. But is there evidence that a flying saucer crashed there? No. Is there evidence something crashed there? Yes.
Okay, so if there was anything other than a extraterrestrial craft, shall we say,
right,
that crashed there, and they've admitted something has crashed there, what else would it be? Have they given an explanation? Have the authorities given an explanation? Well, it wasn't a UFO, it wasn't an extraterrestrial, but it was blank.
Blank, right. No, actually, we've spent a lot of time down at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the archives of all the Air Force activities from the inception of the Air Force. And they're very good about giving us maps of New Mexico and dates and crash reports on things that have gone bad. Oh, maybe 20, 25 miles east of the crash site, there's a crash site of an old Phantom F4 that had issues and the pilot punched out and the craft went down. You can still find the aluminum remains of it in the desert floor. There's nothing, anything closer than that F4 crash, which I say 20, 25 miles maybe away. So it's not like the government said, oh yeah, that was a flying wing that crashed in the late 40s, or there's no explanation.
No explanation. They say something crashed, but they can't really say what crashed. Eh?
Well, the Air Force never says anything crashed there. The naysayers say, well, yes, something crashed there, but it wasn't.
Okay.
No, and the Air Force are amazingly great to work with when you get down to Maxwell. They're really there to help you.
Good. I need to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, as well as Dr. Frank Thayer. And if I may, I would like to get back and speak with Suzanne. How are you, Suzanne?
Doing well, thank you.
Very good, very good. Now I'm going to put you on the spot here. You and Scott were on the show a while back here. I forget the date, year. But at any rate, at that time, you promised that you would tell us where they moved the craft to. So where did they take that craft?
I can't definitively say that.
Don't do it again, Suzanne.
Hey, one of the things you'll find with our work is that we tell you the truth, and that's why our books are built on. And if it's something that we're unsure of or it's a hunch, then we clearly say that. But you're not going to hear any fast talk from us. If we don't know, we're just going to say that. We have hunches, but I don't really feel good about saying that. We have actually, I can say this much, that bits and pieces have gone to several locations. Talk about some of the locations that bits and pieces have gone. So it isn't like we can say definitively the craft was picked up and moved. And here's, let me elaborate for just a second. The craft was taken apart into four pieces. And it was put together like a tongue and groove. So there were no nails or screws or anything like that. Once it was taken apart, there were certain scientists that were brought from, frankly, all over the world, really, some of the top scientists to do research on it. And it was very compartmentalized. There were those that worked on the metals. There were those that worked on the equipment and the technology. There were those that worked on the bodies. There were a variety of people. So it's not a simple answer. I'm not trying to avoid the question or avoid the answer. It's just, it's more complex than that. But I can give you, Scott, between the two of us, we can give you a list of some of the places that some of the equipment went to.
I think originally it went to Los Alamos, which would make sense. That's where you have 10,000 of the smartest people in the world at that time working there.
Right. Well, you said something, Scott, about Holloman Air Force Base.
That's where the M25 tank retrieval machines came from.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. The I think the craft at some point spent some time. We've interviewed a gentleman that everything he told us so far about him and his life has checked out, where he worked, where he lived, where he paid taxes. And he was moved down from Rochester, New York, down to Dayton, Ohio, where he claimed he worked on a craft that was very similar in description.
Mm-hmm.
He was there purely for some instrumentation. We'll have a blog about that in our new book coming out. He said after several years at Wright-Patterson, he said they still had no idea how the machine operated. Now, this is back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about the Aztec disc, it was virtually intact. It wasn't a debris field. It wasn't shattered a million pieces. It was virtually intact. So they had a pretty good piece, a working piece to work with.
Right. I was going to ask Suzanne, you may have already answered this question. There have been many other alleged, anyway, UFO crashes, UAP crashes. What was unique about this incident?
Oh my gosh. You know, one of the things that I think has kept us going for 30 some years on this particular incident is more and more information continues to unfold. And it's a very complex story because we have so many of the details. I can't just tell you in five words or less, there was a crash in Aztec, New Mexico. Well, is what happened or near there, but there's so much more. And the beauty of this particular story, unlike almost any other story that you know of that's UAP or UFO related, is that we have the pre-sightings throughout New Mexico by law enforcement, military, and civilians. Then we have the actual incident itself. We have the witnesses, we have, which are vast. We have a county commissioner, we have a sheriff, we have several police officers, we have some ranchers, a minister, oh my gosh, some military folks that were out of the military, a vast amount of people. So we have the witnesses, then we have the scientists, which we've been able to find and locate the scientists, that some of the scientists that have worked on it, mm-hmm. and then the physical evidence at the site, and then the cover-up. And I don't use that word loosely. Cover-up, you know, gets thrown around all the time. We literally can track the cover-up, and from J. Edgar Hoover to military records to FBI, CIA records, and it actually speaks about this incident. So the beauty of this is we can follow it all the way through. Oftentimes you're limited with an incident of this type with someone saw it or someone had contact with it or, you know, someone worked on it, but it's only pieces of it. We feel very fortunate in the fact that this particular incident, you can follow all the way through. And that alone makes it really unique. Mm-hmm. Plus, as Scott mentioned, the craft, aside from a small crack in one of the portholes, was a crack about the size of a quarter. Aside from that, it was all intact. And the number of beings that were inside, and 16, that's a substantial amount.
Oh, yeah. And
they were burned, but they were fully intact. You know, it's you have people that saw the craft as it was just before it crashed. You have people, oil field workers on the Mesa that saw it. I mean, there's just so many layers to this, and you could possibly dismiss some of the facts, but it's real hard to dismiss that many layers.
Really? Well, You've said that you have over 55,000 documents pertaining to this incident. What type of documents are we talking about here?
We've got military records from the Air Force, the Army, Army CID, FBI, maps, a little bit from the CIA, and everything from archival articles from that time frame to declassified documents that we worked years to get, very hard to get documents.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to research something like this, at least our method is, let's say that we're investigating a witness. We don't just, not that we dismiss someone, but we have to follow through. And as Scott lightly touched on, follow through and investigate that person and find their credibility, see if other things that they've said are true. And if we can start to compile a foundation of truth for their testimony. So those are all documents that are included in that too. I mean, literally when we have a new lead, it sometimes takes us a year or two to qualify it. So it's not just, oh, so-and-so said this. Well, if we can't document it, then we put it in that category that, you know, this person said this, but we have no way to qualify this.
Mm-hmm. As long as you have the truth, right? Well, let me do this. Let me take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey and Dr. Frank Thayer. Let's go to Dr. Thayer. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, paying close attention to my colleagues.
How long have you been working with them? Since 2009?
Yes, they came to me. I had had an item on my website in 2006, and they somehow found it. I had read William Steinman's book about the crash at Aztec. And at that time, we have to remember that it was still considered a hoax. As a matter of fact, confidentially, Wikipedia still says it's a hoax. And that there's a story behind that. But I got very interested because I'm from New Mexico and I had followed the Roswell incident since 1978. And here was something that I had heard about, but had also heard that it was not real. And I learned when the Ramseys got in touch with me, I was ignited. I was ready to go. And I've been at it for almost two decades now. And still, I keep finding new things and everything points to reality. Usually when you study a story, whether it's about the lone gunman in Dallas or whatever, the evidence just doesn't fit, not quite. Right. But everything we found says, yes, it really happened. And that has always astounded me. And I never lose interest in it.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And what makes you think that you've discovered the correct spot of this crash?
That I think that Scott knows this, and that's how he found it, that somebody in Aztec say, oh, the old crash site, and they told him where it was. But Frank Scully's book has turned out to be completely accurate. It's been trashed, but it turns out that everything he has in there is verifiable. William Steinman was the first to go from California to Aztec to see if he could find the site. And he used Scully's directions and he landed on the mesa and he found it. And he was so excited about it. And so it wasn't just somewhere close to this. It was right on that mesa. And when you stand up on the mesa and you look around, the story makes sense. It just had to be just what you see. And I never lose interest in that.
And who was this Frank Scully that broke the story? Why did he break the story?
You know, Frank Scully was a journalist. He wrote in a breezy conversational style, and that is not scientific, but his book, as told to him by Silas Newton and the anonymous scientist, Dr. G, he took this story and turned it into the first really exciting flying saucer book, sold 50,000 copies. And that book was partially responsible for Suzanne and her family to move to Aztec when she was very young. Mm-hmm. And so this book is, you can count on it. You can read it and say, this is accurate. Frank Scully knew what he was talking about. And the idea of it being a hoax only is dated to 1952, September, when the irresponsible journalist G.P. Kahn wrote the article, I just read it recently, in True Magazine about the mysterious little men. And it was a hit job. He was lying and he was a thief. And his job was to discount Frank Scully's book. Mm-hmm. And it worked. And everybody who says it's a hoax goes right back to that True Magazine article. And there's no real research in it. He's a great journalist, but he was a faker. And his job, I think he worked with Herbert Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover
to discount the book. And it worked.
Yeah.
For decades, it was assumed that there was never anything at Aztec. We know better now. And I do believe that our books in 2011 or 2012 and 2015 have established and proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt, not just preponderance of evidence, but beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about this upcoming book. I heard that there was an upcoming book, right?
We're working on it. I think that this time, instead of proving a case in court, we're starting with the late of the after World War II, going through the discovered flying saucer flaps that came on, then to what happened before Aztec, on Aztec, and all the years since. You're sitting there as though you're watching a movie and watching the story unfold and see how it happened, how it was discounted, how it was turned into a hoax, who discovered it later. Scott Ramsey comes along and follows up William Steinman's research and ends up with probably, I'm biased, of course, the best books ever written on Aztec.
Yeah. Well, as far as
if I may mention something that we really want to stress is, with our other two books, one was self-published, one was with the publisher, you're very limited on number of pictures and documents you can include, and you're limited on number of pages. And so, as I've described earlier, we have a story here that is very complex with many layers, and we have only gotten to include a fraction of the information that we have and the evidence, because you can only include so much. And one of the things the three of us agreed upon was that we need to be able to pass on all of this information. And so the format, as Frank described, of this book would be starting from the beginning, going all the way through, would be the beginning of the book, the first portion. And it would be like a flow chart, and you get to meet every single witness, everything that we have. There are so many fascinating people that are involved with this. And then anything that we're unsure of, that we can't prove, it will include that, but that'll be in a separate section. And you will have everything at your fingertips. Then the last part of the book will be many documents. And so really it will be something that you could actually even teach in school if you wanted to. And it will be what we feel a good documentation of this case and for historical purposes. And then who knows what the future holds if somebody needs to pick up the leg and take the next leg of it. But we just feel it's really important for this information to get out and not be locked away. And when our time come and goes, that it just be burned or thrown away and all that time and effort be for naught.
Well, that's the thing about books, you know, they live forever, hopefully, you know, and as long as they're still in print.
Right.
Self-published books will never go out of print.
Right.
You know? So mm-hmm. Is this upcoming book is self-published or with your publisher?
We're going to self-publish it.
We'll self-publish it because we want to be able to include everything. And if we had a publisher, that probably wouldn't be possible. And there's lots of limitations. So this would really be, in other words, what you'll have the opportunity to do is follow our research all the way through instead of getting just chunks of it.
Did you say that there have been a lot of invitations to publish your book?
We've had several.
The second book we did was done through a publishing company.
Oh, okay. But you'd rather not do that?
No, we'd rather have full control of the book, full control of the cover, and like Suzanne and Frank said, be able to put everything in there knowing it's going to stay and not get deleted out.
Right.
It's going to be really big, as Sullivan once said.
A really big book. Is it going to be a tome, shall we say?
What's
that? Turning into it.
A tome, a big book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's turning into being a big book. Yeah.
Well, that's all right. You know what? It's like a kind of a scrapbook, in other words. So.
Your first books were more story like this happened, that happened, and. Correct me if I'm mistaken, but that's the way I take them in the past. But this is more documentation than one that's coming.
Well, the first two books were a little bit of story and a little bit of documentation, but okay. None of them as much as we would have liked to have. And you really don't get in. I mean, you get the briefly go over the story, but you can't really get into it very deep.
Mm-hmm. So how many of these witnesses / scientists are still alive?
None that we know of.
Witnesses. We've got a witness that we have visited with recently, and there is a witness that still might be alive.
But any of the scientists that worked on it are long gone.
Yeah. So,
but some of them were alive during the time that we've been doing this research.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I understand that. Working on it that long, they would be, but back in 48 is when it happened. So it would be a far stretch to ask that they, you know, be alive and be able to be interviewed.
Well, Stanton Friedman had a great line. When you're doing this kind of research, you're always racing the undertaker. And that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Let me interject something here.
Please.
Going way back to the beginning of the incident when Scott was doing his research, he found two living people who were there on the mesa, walked up on the saucer, and they didn't know each other. And they told Scott the same story. They had never colluded. And that is, to me, one of the most confirming testimonies you can ask for in court. That two people who didn't really know each other, they told the same story in detail,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to tell it to Scott Ramsey. That is priceless.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree wholeheartedly. Were you going to say something, Scott?
Yeah, Doug Nolan was one that I interviewed before he died, and he lived at the time in Mancos, Colorado, which is, 45-minute drive from Aztec. And the other gentleman I interviewed down in Batcave, Arizona, was simply passing through the Durango, Cedar Hill, Aztec area to meet up with an old Navy buddy, and they're going on to San Diego. And I mean, all the way down to details of the craft, 10 years apart from when I interviewed the one to the other. And that kind of sold me that got to keep going on the research.
Yeah. So the documentation that we were referring to, I assume that this is all scattered all over the place, this place and that place. Or where would we be able to go to and see this or research ourselves, these documents ourselves?
We have a lot here right now because we're using them to work on the book. I think eventually what they did with Frank Scully's incredible collection is they donated it to the University of Wyoming in Laramie, which is a huge archive of people that write books and write plays and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And Mike Price and I went out there and worked in the archives for 5 days going over all of Frank Scully's work, which is amazing. Letters back and forth, court documents about the trial of Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer that really show what a hoax and a farce it was. And I think a place like that would be a good resting home when we're done with all these writing books, to take all those documents and put them out there at Laramie.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, have you mentioned this trial that you're talking about?
We'll go into detail in the book.
Yes.
Can you kind of give us a
skeleton? Well, basically, if you listen to the skeptics and the naysayers, Silas Newton was arrested and Leo Gebauer for conning people out of money. And really, when you look at the court records and you look at what they arrested him on, was a misdemeanor, and it was taking a check written to him in Colorado and cashing it in his bank account in Phoenix, Arizona. Taking a check across state lines that was for fraudulent purposes. When you get to the trial, there was no fraudulent purpose. He bought something and somebody bought something from him. The whole thing was in 1952, in my opinion, was to, and what Dr. Thayer was saying, that the book sold over 50,000 copies. It sold over 64,000 and just about came to a screeching halt by the time the trial hit. And I think what the government did was they were very successful in putting out a bad cover story, a black ops cover story, to take truth and any light off of Frank Scully's book and tarnish it with a story about two con men. and it worked very well.
So what was the upshot of this trial? Guilty, not guilty?
They got off and they had to pay the legal fees in the trial. Frank, correct me if I'm wrong. Did they find him guilty of one thing?
Yes, the jury found both of them guilty, but they were not sentenced. They were put on probation and asked to pay court costs, no fines, no felony sentence, and then it evaporated. It was obviously designed to besmirch the reputations of Newton as a source for Scully. And it ruined Scully's book almost overnight. And J.P. Kahn was in the courtroom the whole time. That was all he had in his life after that True Magazine article. He was there in the courtroom and he wanted to see them taken down. And he would do anything to see that happen. And you talked to his friend after he died. Was Clay, and I think that was unfortunate because J.P. Kahn is a great writer. I read his article again, and if I didn't know any better, I would assume that what he said was all true. It turns out it wasn't, and it was Newton and, well, let's jump ahead. There was a $12 million lawsuit filed against J.P. Kahn, Ken Purdy of True Magazine, and others involved. And I assume because the judgment was sealed, that they paid.
Right.
Don't you agree, Scott?
Yeah, absolutely. There are actually a couple, because we found a couple. I think we found one in New York, one in New Jersey. And I don't know why Newton and Scully did the lawsuits in different locations, but the skeptics, you never hear anything about that.
No.
No, and here's part of the problem. When you see on the internet about 50% of the time that the Aztec crash is a hoax, the problem is three people that are so-called, what do I want to call them? Debunkers or, I don't know, naysayers. Three fairly well-known people jumped on and said that it was not true. Well, a couple things that we investigated on those three people are, one is they've never been to the crash site. Not one of them had ever been to the crash site. Two, they read on the internet, which we all know is subject to whoever writes. You don't even have to put your own name if you're authoring something. So you don't know how credible that is, but they only read part on the internet. They never finished a story. So in other words, it's like watching a movie. You get halfway through, you don't know how it ended. And that's, they're making their judgment halfway through when people say that it's a hoax, because the rest is documented and you follow on through to closure.
Mm-hmm. David, we had a cousin of mine go on Wikipedia, and he did the cover for our first book. He does beautiful work. He went on Wikipedia and changed the whole Wikipedia article on Aztec and filled in the blanks with facts from our book. And it was changed in 24 hours or less than 24 hours.
That information was changed, you say?
Yeah. You can go in and edit Wikipedia.
Yeah.
But somebody that quickly went in and changed it.
And returned it to the original hoax story.
Right, right. We went back to the hoax story.
Do you have the feeling that the government, some arm of the government has a hand in this?
You think?
Yeah. You said sarcastically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think the government / naysayers are going to do now that the Pentagon, the Navy, and hopefully soon the Air Force has admitted, and in fact, the Air Force pilots have pretty much admitted these things exist.
Right.
It's great the way they put it in their admission. They're not ours. They're not U.S.'s. Not United States technology. And they describe how they go from 0 to 7,000 miles an hour and make 90 degree turns on a dime without slowing down, et cetera, et cetera. And we do not have that kind of technology. It is either, these craft are either Russian, Chinese, or other.
Right.
Other assume meaning ET. Now, which would you rather, let me ask you, Frank, which would you rather it be? Russian, Chinese, or other?
I think that I'll pick C.
Why is that, though? Qualify your answer.
Well, it's from the very beginning, there was these discussions of, well, is it ours? Back in the 40s, they were saying, well, are these Soviet aircraft flying in our skies? And as today we have such wonderful technology, the Russians are supposedly using hypersonic missiles in Ukraine, and well, maybe now they're going to say, well, these flying saucers, they were really Russian missiles. They love that, the Russians, but the Russians didn't have any. They were trying to copy our B-29s in the late 40s, and that's the Tupolev was an example of that. And they didn't have the technology. Today they have better technology, but nobody, even today, can do this kind of thing, even though we hear stories like Bob Lazar and Area 51. Supposedly we are back engineering. I'm skeptical of that at this point, but the flying saucers could do it in the 1940s and probably could have done it much earlier. What do you think, guys?
Yep, I agree.
I agree.
You say you're skeptical of what?
Well, I'm just the idea that it's earthly technology that's caused all these sightings for the last 80 years. It just doesn't make any sense and has been proven wrong. And they just hope that people will forget. What is that Merlin said in the movie Excalibur, 1983, it is the doom of men that they forget.
Yes, brilliant. Yes. And sometimes it's that we remember too much. We remember the negative.
All those here present.
I'm afraid so. But I thought you had said, I guess I'm mixing it up. I thought you had said that taking their technology and reverse engineering it for our own use. And were you skeptical of that?
Well, I think we're doing it. Okay. But we have an example in our upcoming book about Wright-Patterson, where supposedly, even in 1958, they had not even begun to understand how those craft operated. Yeah. And I assume they've made progress since then, but I don't know. So I'm not, if we did this, why would we still be sending chemical rockets to the moon and the Mars? It just doesn't make any sense.
Right. At the same token, on the Aztec craft, there were some things that were interesting technology. And again, this was 1948. One of them was like a compact disc. Another was like a flat screen TV, mirrored like sunglasses. Am I missing something?
No, that's, you got
that. Yeah, they, and I know Stan Friedman had some interviews on Roswell where the flat screen TV came up as well, but that was description inside the craft. And we have some really good illustrations that were done by a good artist that'll be in the new book too.
Oh yeah, those are great.
Go ahead.
Let's not forget that after Roswell, 6 months later, the transistor appeared in Bell Labs.
Yeah.
And that was revolutionized electronics. And would it have happened without a flying saucer crash? I can't say, because I really think people are brilliant, but I don't believe in coincidence either.
Yeah. And right after 47, right after the Roswell crash, I think it was 6 months, something like that.
Yes.
NSA was established. Mm-hmm. You know, the no such agency. But, you know, why then? We had a World War One. We had World War Two. We had Korea. Mm-hmm. Well, Korea was later, but I mean, after World War Two, why didn't we wait till then to get NSA, that type of a organization?
I don't believe in coincidence. There was an overwhelming need for this. This is the greatest secret we've ever kept in government.
We have help from a gentleman by the name of Bob Coford out in California. Bob is an incredibly good researcher. His expertise is CIA, Air Force, NSA, things like that. And on March 25th, 1948, the documents he has compiled of how fast things changed in our government and the military are mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
On that day of the crash.
That day of the Aztec crash, that's how fast some things changed.
Yes.
The Aztec crash as well. But right after Roswell,
he
started coming up with a lot of stuff.
Right. And there's that time frame in between and then we'll show you the documents in our book, but they are put in effect March 25th, 1948.
Do you have a working title for this book? Or
not exactly. Not really. We've mulled around some things, but
We just playing around with it.
It's important, but it's kind of like once we get it all pulled together, we'll have a better sense of what its name will be.
Mm-hmm. But it will have the words Aztec Crash in it, right?
I would think.
Probably.
Yeah.
Or 2.0, right?
Yeah, there you That's go. Right. Aztec 2.0, there you go.
Right. Let me ask you this. Suzanne, what is the most, what stands out most about your research?
Oh, I think for me, personally, it's been the impact that it had on people's lives. There was a gentleman that was a survivor of the Bataan Death March, and he was one of the witnesses, and how it impacted his life. And, you know, I lived in the Four Corners in that area of New Mexico, and talking to some of these people, I can just see the impact that it had on their lives. And I'm fascinated by how this just interrupted their life and they had to continue on. And
and
it's just fascinating to me. I'm kind of fumbling for words because it's hard to describe. It's really very hard to describe.
No, I understand what you mean because it's like any UFO sighting. Keep calling it UFO, I'm used to it. UAP sighting. it changes your life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It does. Just the fact that you see it.
And you know, we had a minister that came upon and drove up the road, a Baptist minister, and thought that maybe there was a crash, an airplane crash or something. And he headed up the road, the dirt road, and asked if there was any way that he could help. All the witnesses were gone at this point, and it was just the military. And they said, well, we could use your help on something. And they climbed up the mesa, and it's quite a hike, and they got over the hill, over the top of the mesa, and here all these bodies were laying out. And they walked over to him, and they kind of indicated, could you do something like last rites or something? And they were all dead, of course. And he said, you know, I'm not a priest, you know. And they said, well, could you say some prayers? So he said prayers, and he just, the feeling that I get from it is that he just was in such shock after saying these prayers and seeing these bodies of like children, that he kind of stumbled back to his car and had quite a drive back up to Mancos, Colorado. He gets there and he calls together a few of his friends in his congregation and shares this story. And he's so shook up and he's crying. And their question was, are you crying because it questions your faith, or, you know, what is it? And they said, no. He said, seeing these poor bodies laying there of like children and the impact. Well, the impact that would have on somebody is just incredible. Or these scientists crawling in and seeing all these things that we couldn't even dream of before this, and what they're going to do with it. And there's just so many avenues. It's never boring, you know, in all these years, it's never been boring at all.
Well, Scott and Suzanne and Frank, I am very sorry, but we're going to have to wrap it up. I thank you all so much for joining us. And I look forward to that, your new Aztec book. Your first one was called what?
The Aztec Incident, Recovery at Heart Canyon.
The Aztec Incident. And the next one, I'm sure, will be just as good. I've read that, your first one. And I look forward to reading that. Maybe we'll do this again sometime.
There you go.
Thank you, David, very much. You always
are David. And you're out for fascinating
information.
Thanks so much.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you'll find my website with all the archive shows. Please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then... This is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.